Good evening, friends. As was announced, the title of today's talk is The Life Beyond Death. It's a wonderful paradox that at one breath we are speaking about life while we are going to consider a life which is beyond death. Yet the life, of course, means a continuity of consciousness, a continuity of vital living beyond the threshold of death. Now this is an affirmation. An affirmation not only projected by theosophy, but down the ages, every traditional religions, even traditional religions, acknowledge at least this much fact, that there is some continuation beyond the threshold of death. We shall soon see the logic of that, because this is not something which is thrown on the face of people by as a dictum with some authoritarian dogma. But behind that, there is a distinct law. Which law we are going to explain and try to understand in the course of this lecture. Now this topic of death, supposed to be, once I spoke to a friend, he asked me, well, what subject is this? He gave the title, well, what such a morbid subject you people are discussing? Now, this is the attitude of the mind. People think this is too morbid, too depressing to be considered, at least by the young people. A young man said that. So as to why should we study this topic? What is it that motivates us, at least to consider for a while? As the previous speaker mentioned very rightly, that no less than Sri Krishna, in the, I think the 7th or 8th chapter, advocates that we must meditate on the subject of life and death and many other things. In fact, Buddha, when he was confronted with this tremendous experience of death, not his own, and not even of his own dear ones, but others, and when he realized that it can happen even to him and his beloved wife and his two young little boy, he was shocked. It was a shock of revelation to him that death is certain to all things living, that anything that has a beginning must end. It's only the death which is the beginningless and the end is the thing that is endless. It is this shock which made him turn towards higher life and start in search for the meaning of pain, meaning of suffering, meaning of death. So it is possible for some of us at least that this face to face, very often it is the event of death in the family which makes the people question the subject of death. This student had an experience at Matunga Lodge on two occasions. Two ladies on two separate occasions have lost their dear son. And one of them, she lost her daughter, and one of them said that, I have heard that your office are conducting seance rooms and that you will be able to communicate, help us to communicate with the dead. And that was a misconception she was carrying. So she said, we will be able to help her. And that's why she contacted us. And another lady, she had nurtured her son for 18 years. He was a retarded child, right from birth till his death. And she was feeling guilty that she was not able to look after him in the last few months because of some commitment elsewhere. So she felt that, how can I once again come in touch with that boy? And that I would like to know what is going to happen to him. Is he still in a crippled condition? Is he still in the same state? Can I contact him? I only wish I could get a dream of my child, and so on. So it is the grief sometimes which brings people to question the subject of death. But then, besides that, there are negative attitudes, fear, anxiety, rejection, even rebellion. You see, some people, they feel rebellious at the very idea of that. After doing all those labor and effort, you think I'm going to leave all this behind? Should I die? It's something about, it is unthinkable. People are not able to confront it, face it. That can also happen. and helplessness is the most common experience of mankind. And it is that brings us questioning about what could be the possibility. Whether is there a continuity or is there survival beyond the threshold of death? This question people ask, and they want evidence, they want actual proof, they want some kind of supporting logic behind this. And this is what the burden of today's talk. You see, it seems that there is also the irrational belief among many religious people that after that there is going to be a long, long lasting heaven and a long, long, almost eternal hell for those who are sinners. And this kind of thing appears to be so illogical to some young people, because they say, after 60, 80 years of life, should I be rewarded for an eternal vacation in heaven or an eternal hell somewhere? It's irrational. A short life and a tremendous long period of rewards or punishment. So again, to that is the spiritual answer. Then psychologists have tried to explore it, but they have not been able to explore there are certain other levels of the mind. There are many psychologists who are actually admitted that there are various, states of consciousness which they are not able to probe accurately. Within experimental basis. But then there is what is known as an ancient psychology, the Oriental psychology, which has come down the ages. It is an accumulated wisdom of the ages that has come back to us. And that wisdom is passed on. But before that, there have been experimenters. And that even within our recent lifetime, there have been people who have personally experienced the experience of death through which they passed, and were able to bring back the memory of those experiences to be able to relate it to others. And the most fundamental thing that they were able to are convinced about is the deathlessness of the human consciousness. The real inner consciousness is absolutely deathless. That it continues and it can never die because it never had a beginning. Now, of course, among the Zoroastrians, there is what is known as an ancient tradition called Ardha Viraf Nama. A great sage called Ardha Viraf was a priestly chief minister of a king. And
very near, because you won't be heard.
Again, wanted to know what is it, what happens to a person after death. And he said, I don't think I'll be able to answer you straight away, but I can try. So he performed certain rituals, and then he said that please preserve my body for a certain number of days. And with the help of the other fellow priests, he went into a trance. And he, for 4 days, he is said to have gone into the other side of life, beyond death. And then came back on the 4th day and reported to the king what he had experienced. He said, report in a very poetic form. Unfortunately, that also has been muddled up by various translators in later life. Because it was originally in Pahlavi, and then later on in Persian, and then later on in Gujarati literature. So the description somehow or other matches with what is theosophical presentation. Within our century, last century at least, Ramana Maharshi at the age of 9 or 10 wanted to know what is it that survived, what is it that is permanent part of me. Somebody said so. He wanted to find out. And he was so obsessed with that idea that he ran away from his house, hid himself into a little cottage, and went into a trance, and in that he experienced the spiritual consciousness. And then it was then he realized that that which is the real man is the permanent individuality in him, and the rest of it is something which are the dregs which has to be discarded behind. So this fundamental philosophical truth actually was impinged on him as a very little child, 8 or 9, Ramana Maharshi. At least this has been recorded. So this records of these great sages and seers have been very nicely resolved. In fact, they have been retested, re-verified. They have not merely swallowed headlong, but they have been re-verified by various sages which came later on. And I'm sure that there are stages about which you are going to soon see the beyond the threshold there. Now, theosophy always, of course, does not merely is a descriptive science. It offers the laws governing the evolution of man and the laws which concern nature, and man being a part of that nature. But this, of course, information is very useful in one sense. It can help us, of course, to face our own death. It can help us, of course, to face the possibility of our dear departed one, how to face that grief experience. And another, to be able to console others. Because if you are very much convinced in the sense that by lying, nobody really loses everything. That the one whom we really love is the permanent man, is the real man. You see, from a mother who has loved the baby from childhood to the ripe age, she has seen the child into all the transformation. But the person whom she loved is the same person, the same individual, the same ego, the same individuality, the same soul. So this gap which runs, a kind of a thread runs together. So this kind of certitude which dawns on people, that's it. If it continues throughout, it is going to continue. Just as when we go to sleep and we wake up, but we are the same person as we wake up. That is almost like a dream, like a sleep. Going into sleep and you awaken into a grandeur of a great life. And then you have shed behind all those laborious burden on the soul. In fact, it is because of this tremendous labor and weight on the soul that the soul decides to desert the body. So, therefore, as Rilke pointed out, there is no death for the real man. The death is, of course, that belongs only to the personal man, the physical man. It is that which dies. That's why it says, no, the death is certain to all things living. Of course, and then immediately he covers himself and rebirth to all mortals. That is another great hope. That you not only death is that you certain, but look, you are going to come back in other words, because that also is equally certain for the mortal. That which has not completed is immortality, the purpose for which it has taken birth. Another important thing about this second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is that it helps us and it insists. See, when Arjuna was in grief, the only way by which Krishna can console him is presenting this idea. That there is that undying part of your nature. Not only you and all the princes of the earth have always been existing and will forever continue to exist again and again and again. What is that to grieve, he said? Because what happens is that merely an act is an incident in the whole eternity of the life. It's merely a little incident. So what is there to grieve, he tells him? Because you have got the greater grief, immediately it ends with that. But for you at present, there is an immediate duty to perform. That's our last words of this today's reading. Your duty is to present yourself immediately now and here. What is there to grieve about those who are going to die? Because they are as good as that. They are limited. In that sense, this discriminating faculty has to be awakened. So our today's subject will really help us to discriminate, to help us to discriminate. But that is that eternal part of it, the undying part of it, the immortal part of our nature, and that is the mortal side, which keeps changing. Really, it is not only a mortal, but this keeps changing. Hourly we change. In fact, according to the ancient science, it is called Nitya Pralaya. Every minute of our life, our cells are dying out in the body. Not only that we are going to die at one particular moment and that body is going to die ultimately, but the body is dying every second. In that sense, that certain important cells, even within the brain, they are dying and they are being replaced. They are dying and being replaced. A continuous battle going on between these two forces. In fact, in theosophy, we are all told that there are two kinds of life, the creative and the destructive, and there is a balance between the two, and when the balance is lost, death takes place. So there is a continuous refreshing and renewing of our life sense. And of course nature is so cyclically that after spring, autumn leaves are falling, then winter, the tree is almost denuded, and then the spring comes, the flowering takes place. So cycle is complete. So in nature, at one time, at one stage, there is a power of destruction apparently, but then it is also there for regeneration. In fact, that is one of the quality of what is the tradition, which is supposed to be the trait of Shiva, the great Rudra Deva. Rudra Deva is that who destroys. He forcefully takes away. He is also called Yama Deva. He may forcefully take away the soul to heaven world. But in order that he may recharge, he may come back refreshed. So that is a regenerative process that can take place after that. So this separation is necessary, because it is only through this that the real inner man finds his true freedom. Because it is only then, of course, every night we do only that our body is temporarily paralyzed, our brain is silent, and then the ego is free to enter into a sushupti state. Then he is free to communicate with his higher, with his parent, and receive inspiration from them. So in that sense, there is some parallelism between life, between death and going into deep sleep condition. So it is as good as that. So when a child grieves, you remember when he was small, your parents used to say, when the grandparent dies, the mother said that, oh, my grandmother has gone to Pullivani, a very pleasant place. And he said, why should you grieve? My mother was very sensible. She said, you should not grieve. Now she has gone into a very long vacation. A kind of a very beautiful place she is going. A very nice, charming place from this ugly heaven, ugly world. Of course, we miss her, but she has not really left us. She is still with us. This kind of assurance given to a child has remained with this student. So this is how it is that when somebody is grieving, this kind of message told to a child that dying is merely going on a very long, pleasant vacation. So why should we grieve? It is selfish to grieve that, oh, he has gone away and left me. I mean, to some extent, it is selfish. So one should be secretly rejoicing that at least my beloved, who had suffered so long, supposing that person has suffered during lifetime. It is good that a good relief is given by nature out of kindness. So then, that is one of the reasons why that in nature, of course, there is a renewal, a continual death, and life goes on in cycles. And of course, in man, we saw that when the body cannot cope with the demands of the soul, when the soul is frustrated through that ailing body, when the soul knows that it cannot any further make progress, it decides to discard the body. So it is the inner man, the real man, the immortal part of our nature, which gives consent to the individual that, come on, now it is time to shed the body. Without that consent, the person in coma can go on and on sometimes for months and days and years together. But once that inner consent comes, when the ego feels that it cannot no longer stretch further into that helpless this body, it discards it. So that is actually one of the reasons why that is dead. Then we must also ask why life? Because life will explain that. Although, as we just said, Buddha, he went out to inquire into the meaning of that. So the meaning of that, the meaning of pain and meaning of suffering, made him realize the meaning of and the purpose of existence. Now we come to this process of death, because that is something worth learning. Now, this process takes place at three definite stages. One is immediately when the doctor declares, immediately when the heart stops. By the way, there are two kinds of death biologically. What is called the clinical death, when the doctor declares, when the heart stops, when the circulation stops. And that is what is called cerebral death. Cerebral death is the one when the brain stops completely functioning. When you go into electroencephalogram, the electrical impulses in the brain stops. And even if the body is icy cold, the brain inside is warm enough for a definite purpose. So the last purpose, the soul withdraws itself and focuses itself into and becomes active in the brain. Although now the person is not conscious enough to tell us so, unless that person returns. There are people who have got into temporary state of death and have revived. So those who have revived after death have been able to tell us that they have the post-mortem conditions of their life. And this seems to be almost common among all people, that this slowly slipping, you might say, gradually going down into a slope and entering into the end of a tunnel beyond which there is light. This is a kind of common experience. So it is a regression, such a slow that you do not even feel it. And then beyond that you still continue to believe that you are living. So that individual who has left the body is not even aware that he is dead. So there is a continuity of consciousness. So this is a reporting coming from near-death experiences. So now the process of death is actually nothing else but the withdrawal of the consciousness and focusing into the center of himself. And because now we are free of the burden of the body, the burden of the lower mind, the burden of the outward forms of life, that individual is now free to take charge. And here now, he is being presided over by Yama, you might say. This is a poetic way of saying it. Among Zoroastrians, we said that Brahmanam Shaspan and Saros Yazar presides over that. So among the other tradition, said Yama presides over that because he helps you to go beyond the threshold of that and undertakes the journey. So this, at that stage, it is called a kind of a review takes place. So as the individual withdraws into the brain, he undergoes an actual review of his past life with a definite purpose. In the presence of his higher nature, in the purpose of the God in him. For once, of course, there is a union, conscious, if not conscious, semi-conscious union between personal consciousness and the higher consciousness. And in that conjunction, that person is able to actually see the last life that he has lived and see the justice of it. So he gains some kind of an insight into his past life as to why he had undergone all this suffering and pain and relationships and all this muddle up within a short span of life in which he dwells in that brain. And therefore it is better that the brain should be preserved. And therefore the body should not be immediately discarded at the end of death. Allow the person to undertake that review. It takes from few minutes to about 8 hours or so. And therefore the body must be preserved before you take it for cremation. Now, in that review, it takes with it, at the same time, it gathers some kind of the aroma, the essential part of his nature. And this is what our reading says. It's very interesting reading from Key to Theosophy. It's then in your hand, the very first page. Death is not dying, it is waking into another life. That's what we said. At the solemn moment of death, at the solemn moment of death, and it is not just 1 second, as you say, it is some few minutes to about 8 hours. Every man, even when death is sudden, sees the whole of his past marshaled before him in its minutest details, and for one short instant, the personal becomes one with the individual, the real permanent man, and the all-knowing ego. This is what we really are, the all-knowing ego. He lives his life remaining as a spectator, looking down into the arena he had just left, and he feels and knows the justice of all the suffering he had undertaken him. So these memory pictures come before his mind's eye, and out of which he picks up whatever is consubstantial with his true nature. Whatever that is worthy of taking up with him, the fruits, the food that he has to take with him along for further journey. So this is described as an aroma. In his second reading, of course, says the same thing. The spiritual eye, it is that same thing, the conjunction between the individual The spiritual I is immortal, but from your present self, the current personality, it can carry away into eternity, into Devakana, that only which becomes worthy of immortality. And that is known as the aroma alone of the flower that has been mowed down. So the aroma is that extra, the sense, the essential part of that nature, the virtue that he has developed, that which is truly worthy of carrying with you, which is of a spiritual kind. Same thing, of course, the second reading also says, it is called the ideal efflorescence of all the abstract, therefore undying eternal qualities and attributes such as love and mercy, the love of the good, the true and the beautiful, that ever spoke to the heart of the living, ever, even once, to the heart of a living personality, which clings after death to the ego, and therefore follows him further to this, the higher state of Devakana. Apart from Devakana, see, that at least he has gathered the harvest of his last life. That which is truly his own, that which belongs to the higher part of our nature. And if there is an unfortunate man who has nothing to carry with him, nothing good that he has done in his lifetime, it's a pity that he can only carry with him whatever little that he has earned in this life, whatever the beautiful thing that he has thought of, he can only carry that. There is a very funny story which was told to his children, that a man was to be taken to the gallows, and on the way he found a goat which was tied with a thread, with a string, and was not allowed to go, and the goat was trying to reach out to something to eat. So on his way to gallows, he pushes some leaves towards the mouth of the goat, so that goat could eat. The last good thing that he did. And then after he was taken to gallows. So when he awakens from the dead, the first thing he sees is that good action that he has performed, which is rewarding him now. Although he deserved to be gallows, he admitted that he deserved to be gallows, the one good thing seems to be the starting point of his journey towards heaven. So this is what is, that is in a story form, it is told that that which we take with us, the goodness part of our nature, the enriching, the virtues, the values that we have generated in this life, which is the essence part of our true nature, and the lessons that we have learned with us, they reappear at a later stage. But before that, then of course the ego, having undertaken the whole review, takes a little piece of rest, goes from the unconscious, and awakens into a semi-conscious condition called a state. This is also a kind of a, you might call it a locality, an astral, kamalokic locality. It is around the earth. It is called kamaloka because it is a place of kamna. Our vasanas and our lower dregs and all that is of a thing we should be shed. It is, fortunately, it is called purgatory by the Christians. It's kind of a purgatory because we purge all that is defeat, all that is not worthy of taking with us. And that we throw down, we leave behind there, and a separation therefore takes place between our higher nature and that which is not worthy of carrying with us. And it takes place, it is said that it may take a few minutes, maybe a few hours or days, depending upon the psychic energy we have carried with us. If a person has too much of sensuous life and too much of sensuous feelings, then this ego clings, and then it clings to the ego and it wants to experience that thing over and over again. And therefore it remains in that kamalokic state. But then when the ultimate separation takes place, the real man now is really free. And then he awakens into Devakana condition. But then what is left behind is what is known as a kamarupa. The rupa or the form made up of kamana, about our desire nature, about all our lower personality, and that quickly disintegrates in that state if there is no strong cohesive force. But if there is a tremendous urge, a tremendous passionate nature, then it becomes a cohesive force which coheres and keeps those elementals, the lower elemental feelings, desires, passions, urges together, and come a kind of a spook, a kind of a ghost, a kind of a kamalokic shell takes place. Because this shell, which is intelligent, conscious to a certain extent, which can be invited into Siamsu and which will be able to tell you about the personality of the last life that has lived. But we will not go into that because today is not the subject of our talk. So this Kamarupic shell is left behind, because left behind to his own decay, it decays itself like anything, everything else. It dissolves itself, you might say. But the real man now is completely free for once. This separation is considered as a second death, because this is the true death. Now that person can never come back to life. It is a real permanent death. The first death, as we said, was merely a biological death, you might say clinical death, where ultimately there were till the review takes place. But immediately after review, he enters into this. And here also, to some extent, there is the possibility of return. But very, very rare. Whereas, once this separation takes place, there is no more returning to earth until that person is now ready to enter into the joys of heaven. Now, it is said that our after death condition, this is what he says. By the reading, he says, we reap in our afterlife only the fruit of that merit which we have ourselves sown in this. That means the after death state depends entirely upon the quality of life you have lived, which also includes Kamaloka. Even in Kamaloka, depending on the length of that Kamaloka condition, depends upon the nature of the life you have lived. However passionately you have lived, or whether you have lived, most of us are a mixture of good and evil, and whatever little good and evil that you have performed has to be left behind. And it takes place, a kind of a separation takes place in a semi-unconscious condition, so we need not worry about it. It is not hell. Remember, people call that purgatory is equated to hell, but it is not at all a painful case, unless that person is so much attached to his own personal life that he wants to cling to it, and he finds it difficult to let go. That may be the only painful part. So now this entering into this hell state is considered as Devakana, as the word goes, the very name word, Devakana is the land of Devas. In glossary we have a definition, a very simple but beautiful definition we read. It says, Devakana, the dwelling of the gods, a state of intermediate, intermediate between two earth lives, into which the ego, into bracket, ego means Atma Buddhi Manas, or the Trinity made into one, enters. After its separation from Kamarupa and the disintegration of the lower principles on earth. Now this is important, disintegration of the lower principles on earth. This is why there is a belief that if the body must disintegrate also along with the Kamarupic disintegration. So the quicker the body gets disintegrated, the greater the relief for the soul to enter into the world. This is one of the reasons cremation, by which the body gets disintegrated very rapidly, within 2 hours or a few hours, helps for that individual soul to make progress into the world. But then if you think that there are ceremonies by which you help the individual to separate himself from his lower ranks. So people believe in ceremonies, they think the ceremonies help. We'll talk about it little later. Now, since the soul is now free, is completely cut off from this earthliness, so that it is never possible for us to communicate with them. This is a very sad thing, it might appear to us, except there are exceptions. And if you tell a mother that your child is gone and you can never communicate with her, it will be a very painful thing. Because the mothers, sometimes many of us who have lost our dear ones, actually feel the presence of the dear ones from time to time. At least we can dream of them. And sometimes the dream is so vivid. Sometimes the dream, and you can be sure that in that dream you see that person in a little younger form. You can ask the people who have dreamt of their dear ones, and they will say that they have seen their dear ones not in the last stages, in the old age condition. But they've seen them in a very youthful, very charming, beautiful form. So that is a kind of a reflection coming from the heaven world in the Sushupti state. So we can communicate with the departed one in the deep sleep state and get a little information from them, a little communication between loving relationship. It's the love which builds the bridge, remember, it's the love. That, as SPB says, is the only bridge which makes communication between this world and the other. That is why our mother, who is in the delusion of happiness there, because she is thinking so deeply about her loved ones on earth, her own loving children, is able to actually protect her children through the loving thought. The child will not be able to reach up to the mother, but the mother is able to reach down, not she herself, but she sends the feelers to the child because of her loving thoughts. So it's the love that brings about the bridge between the two worlds. That is a great affirmation. In our reading, it is that, in one of your readings, it is that. So now, this Devakani is nothing else but a kind of a subjective experience. Because there is no body there, it is only a pure spiritual body, celestial body. In fact, we always tell the people that Bhagavad Gita says that you discard the old body, worn-out body, is like discarding the old clothing and putting on a celestial body. So now we are in a very luminous body. And in that luminous body we are having whatever food that we have gathered, whatever nourishment of our own making, which we have undertaken on earth, we carry with us. And now is the time for assimilating that food that we have taken along. It's like eating the food and now trying to assimilate. Assimilate means converting into the fabric of our own nature. So all the ennobling feelings, desires, experiences, virtues that you have expressed, lessons that you have learned from those experiences, all that is sattvic food that we can take with us, sattvic spiritual food that we carry with us, is now available to us. So the heaven world is the reward of all that we have undertaken now and here on this earth. So the greater the beautiful life of truth, goodness and beauty that we have lived on this earth gives a reward there in heaven. So that now we have got to live with those things, to chew those things and to assimilate those things and make it a part of our own true nature. That is an opportunity. And that is the purpose for Devaka. The purpose of that state, that heaven world, is of course a period of rest, away from this drudgery of this life, as we said, Vaskara. Because if a mother were to know what is happening to her children on earth, she won't be happy. It's never a bliss, it's never a place of rest. We say, no, Bhagavad-Yaman. Bhagavad-Yaman is a place of rest. Among those Varasthans, it's called Svarga, a heavenly world where you are completely at peace and bliss. But if it is completely peace and bliss, it can be disturbed if you were to look at the earthliness and what's happening there. So fortunately, nature in its kindness has brought about a certain kind of veil and it allowed into a kind of an imaginary world of dreams in which the individual, of course it's an illusory world, agree. It's a world, dream itself is an illusory world, sleep is an illusion. But still it is real to that soul. It is real in the sense that he actually experiences many things, worthwhile experiences. And then the seeds which he has taken with him now, slowly he is fructifying them one by one. So that the whole last thought that he has focused during his life, in fact it is said that the last thought is the starting point of the Devakhanic existence, the last thought of the dying man. And the last thought of the dying man is nothing else but the last focusing thought that on which the heart is set. If a miser is money-minded, his money is there, and he thinks about money only in Kamaloka. And in heaven world, there is nothing to, he has to carry with him, except that his own children that he had loved, at all, if at all he has loved somebody. So the thing that you deal with is this beautiful effervescence part of our nature, which reappears. And therefore a bhakta, and that is, we have got a very beautiful poem, we have got the name of a bhakta, who preached to Krishna, that please appear in my last days, in my last hour, with Radha. She said, please, don't bring her, don't come alone, bring Radha along with you. In a very poetic way, because he loved them both. And that the bhakta says that, please come back to me in my last hour of death. And through, you know, Krishna promises to Arjuna in that seventh chapter, that if you think of me in the last hour of death, which very few of us can do it, because if you are used to contacting our higher nature every moment of our life, then naturally at the last hour, you can always say, Hey Ram, as Gandhiji said. In the last hour, the word Hey Ram comes up to our mouth. Prathipati is also said that when a person is about to die, he must recite either music, or spiritual devotional music, or recite holy words or scriptures in the ears of the dying person or a dead person. And this is a solemn moment, we are told. The moment of death is a solemn moment. When you are there, presiding over death, so when you are there, it's a solemn moment when you cannot, should not disturb that review and should not disturb that separation that takes place. And therefore, it's no use grieving then. You may grieve little later if you want to break your heart afterwards. But please, let us, as Bhagwan, let us advise, please don't do that, don't grieve over the death. Because you are thereby disturbing the peace of that soul. Now, so it is the rest for a very tired soul. It has to exhaust its psycho-spiritual energy that you have generated in life. And some kind of internal adjustment process. Because our energies that we generate here is in a very confused order. We have our emotions, higher than good emotions, although they may be, but in a very irregular way. So there is some kind of regularization takes place in that energy. In fact, that thing also takes place in sleep. The confused part of the day gets a chance to get it quietly reorganized during sleep. Some problem that you have left out has a chance to get partly solved in deep sleep's condition. Similarly, in the state after death, we get a chance to get reorganized. And therefore, you work out this psychic energy, and when that energy is worked out, there is nothing more that ego has to think of or feel. Now that ego is ready, higher ego is now ready into his last stage, then he is able to now once again enters into what is called the arupa state, without the form. Formerly, now he is in a spiritual form, now he is in a highest beautiful form. And in that form, he is able to see the panoramic view of all the last lives. So here it is described as a sutrapa, is a thread soul upon which all the beads of the past life are strung like various pearls. That is an essential part of his past life. And he sees what is paripaka, what is that ripened part of the past lives, and he brings that and collects it. And he finds, oh, this is a ripened area. And now he decides to make communication with the earth at the appropriate time and place, with that appropriate parent and family. So this is the last review that it is called review. And in that review, he is once again awakened into the supreme beauty of light and sees what is proper for him to go. And he voluntarily decides to choose a body through which he may be able to fulfill his karma. The next burden of karma that he has to fulfill, which is now ripe enough and therefore has to be brought back with him into incarnation. So next karma kshetra, it is this soul himself who decides. So then we have got now a few minutes to answer many questions. If you have any point we have left out within this short time. Yes, madam?
Yeah, I have two questions. In our custom, we don't keep the dead body at night. Suppose I die late evening, I won't have 8 hours, I'll be cremated within 2-3 hours. Then the soul doesn't see the... what happens then?
That means there is a quick disposal of the body.
If
there's a custom.
Suppose I die in the morning, I'll have 8 hours. Suppose I die in the evening, there won't be 8 hours before cremation. Then what happens?
If I were in your place, I would request my family to preserve my body at least for a few hours, so that I'm telling them as to the reason why, that the body needs that the soul needs certain inner readjustment in that moment. So that kind of request can be made. For instance, I can request for the donation of my eye or the donation of my organ. Some kind of request don't be made to our family. Same way, you can make a request of this kind if this is your personal problem. But then, if that is a tradition, it is not a healthy tradition. This is what philosophy states. The reason why the body has to be preserved for a certain number of hours is not too long till it gets start putrefying. But it is better than what is called a rigor mortis, when the body becomes completely stiff. Till such time, the body has to be preserved. And so that the body may have, the person may have a chance to work through whatever that is left out for him to undergo. What's your second question?
But it is also said that even if there is an accident death, or a person dies in explosion, within 2 seconds also it is possible for the soul to take the review. So it is not as if you will miss out on the review because the body is not preserved.
So that's a good contribution, that supposing the body is disposed of within a few hours, immediately stop. At least that body may have a chance to get it. With that chance.
My second question is, suppose a person has been dishonest, so at the end of the review he learns it doesn't pay to be dishonest. So in all his later life he learns a lesson and continues to be honest, or he repeats the mistake?
That depends upon the amount of skandhas that you have generated. One confession or one repentance does not make a person completely reformed. In that review, he is made to see in a very impersonal way. He is not involved in it. He sees it in a very impersonal way. He is above, he is rising above, and sees the lower man undertaking all his experiences. And he sees and picks up from that the best that he knows of. And in which he sees, of course, the wrong that he has done. And regrets, of course, there is some regret. And that helps him to reform himself. But to the extent of his tendencies that he has generated, he has to bring it back along with him at the threshold of Devakana. When he returns, he picks up all that is lower quality as well as his higher nature, in which he has inbuilt character that he has built. He brings it in the next incarnation. And there is hardly any time for any question, then there is a rapid question.
Why is there only love which can be the bridge between two worlds?
You see, according to, you go to any tradition in the world, it is this one thing about which nobody has spoken against it. Love is something so supreme, it is the very foundation of all our life. It is the love that brings into existence the whole universe. That desire that arose in the primal germ of mind is a very compassionate desire. Therefore, compassion is not an attribute, it is not something which is attribute, it is not a character. It is the very basis of our existence. We are here because of this love that has taken place once and is continuing to exist. And it is love that preserves. You know that what is called the dharti, that is being preserved and protected and sheltered, is on account of the divine love. And therefore it is a fundamental nature of the soul to love. The love is its primary characteristics. So there is nothing unusual about that. So now we can end, of course, with this quotation. If you like it. There is hardly a human being whose ego does not hold free intercourse during the sleep in the body with those whom he loved and lost. Yet, on account of the positiveness and non-receptivity of his physical envelope and brain, no recollection or a very dim dream-like remembrance lingers in the memory of the person once away. We are with those whom we have lost in material form, and far, far nearer to them now than when they were alive. And it is this love that is the bridge.